I'm George Liston, CA. Of the 43 presidents who have led the Republic, only a handful have achieved truly iconic status. These are men revered as symbol and substance of qualities the nation cherishes as its own highest expression. For this reason, they endure an image and ideal long after their passage from the scene. Five presidents can readily be placed in this select company: Washington and Jefferson, who founded the nation, Lincoln, who saved it, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who called his country to heroic sacrifice. The fifth great president is Theodore Roosevelt, who personified the nation in his grand ambition, restless energy, and boundless complexity. In this presidential season, as in so many past, many of both parties claim his legacy, and few forget his example. My guest is Kathleen Dalton, author of Theodore Roosevelt, A Strenuous Life. Kathleen Dalton, welcome to Dialogue.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thank you. Teddy Roosevelt, who emerges from your marvelously written book, if I say so, right at the start, is indeed a man of great complexity. I mean, he is a, I guess the Victorians say, a man of parts for his pursuits and his interests, his influence, and as it's charted in the book, the growth of his character and personality. But Kathleen, I also think of him as a kind of a very skilled self-promoter as well. So the first question may be a bit odd, but I sort of wondered if he had written this book about himself, what would he wanted to have underlined or perhaps even left out?
Well, I think he would agree with me that he invented the modern presidency and that he changed a lot of important things. He would like it that I gave him credit for the supporting the Pure Food and Drug Act,
right,
and the Meat Inspection Act and trust busting and standing up to big business and all those things. I think he would like that part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think he would agree with my story of how hard he fought later in life for social justice and
yes,
old age pension and health insurance and, the ideas that became some of Social Security later on, that kind of heroic struggle to the death at the end of his life for what he believed in.
Yes.
So all of that, I think he would not mind having people reminded of in 100 years after he was president.
Right.
All of that, I think he might take some issues with my interpretation of his foreign policy.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little bit more critical of imperialism and the racial undertones of the Spanish-American War and some of his demeaning statements about people of color. And certainly I'm very different from Edmund Morris in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Edmund Morris writes within the empire nostalgia viewpoint,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm much more sympathetic with Mark Twain's view of TR's imperialism,
yeah,
which is that it was excessive. It was not necessarily the way we should have gone,
right,
but it's not the only thing to know about Theodore Roosevelt.
Exactly, and quite frankly, I find your approach very compelling. You know, and this, you just made me think of this in terms of what he might have wished Kathleen Dalton had treated perhaps sotto voce, was the fact you bring out this robust, adventurous, physical dynamo was quite ill for his life, wasn't he? I mean, the asthma wasn't just a childhood thing. It persisted throughout his life.
Right. He wouldn't like people to know that. He tried to hide that.
Yeah.
And clearly we have evidence of a very serious illness, but he wanted to repress it and keep it quiet because his father taught him that illness was a sin.
Yeah.
And so that he thought it was not manly to be vulnerable. And so TR did put on a really important front for the world. And I think to the degree that I get behind that exterior, he might be made uncomfortable by the book. But I think in one sense, the thing I'm proudest about the book is that I did get so close to
yeah,
who he was and listen to his wife and his daughter,
right,
and kind of the interior TR.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. And when you mentioned his father, his wife and his daughter and the manliness thing, I think you come right to the point of my next question, because this man's born on the 27th of October, 1858, into New York's Knickerbocker elite. I mean, it's a family of wealth, position, privilege. And the family seems to remain very important to him throughout his life. His father is Thee, as he's called, becomes a kind of iconic presence, I thought, both when he was alive and after he was dead. And Kathleen, this whole business of manliness and muscular Christianity and this kind of assertiveness. I mean, comment on that, because it seems to me these are major themes that run throughout the course of this man's life.
Well, it was an energizing ideology for him. It was a set of beliefs that helped him define who he was, and it was something that was not unique to TR. English historians have been writing about it for a long time, and they're continental studies of it too. And basically the muscular Christianity comes from a set of beliefs in Christianity needed to be revived and given more flesh and blood in the 19th century, and it was too ethereal and feminized. So it's a movement that starts in England, but it spreads to America. And so TR's raised with muscular Christianity is one of the core beliefs of his childhood. And, you know, to the degree that it's actually a belief system that brings athleticism to America. America didn't have required sports before the late 19th century. And think about how important sports are to us now, and in organized football and baseball. I mean, these are not only big businesses, but they're really almost sacred recreations for us. So muscular Christians changed America in really profound ways, and yet we never talk about what they did to America and for America.
I think one of the phrases you use is Bibles and barbells. And then later, you just reminded me, later in his political career, he actually helps revise the rules of collegiate football to try to keep people from getting killed, and they were killed at great numbers.
Well, one assumption that existed in TR's time about sports and character, I think, isn't working so well in our own time, which is that they really believe that sports and that kind of Spartan discipline would make men pure and help them build better characters, and it would help them resist sensuality and help them be better people. So I think muscular Christianity is a kind of a cultural force that shaped America, but then sports became, I mean, I still do know people who argue that sports builds character, and certainly with little kids you can see that, and self-discipline, but I'm not sure that professional sports build character. I think that's a big question for our society.
I agree with you. That is a big question indeed. You know, I'm just reminded, Kathleen, as you speak, this was a the book depicts well the kind of great ideas that were animating this country and Western Europe, particularly Britain, I suppose. Muscular Christianity, there's this whole notion of, well, imperialism and racialism as a way of looking at people of different color and people beyond our borders and all of that. All of these things seem to make a mindset that was very much the one he necessarily had to inherit, right?
He inherited it. Not everybody was as kind of intense about it as he was. He was really a promoter of some of these ideas and getting people to worry about over-civilization.
Over-civilization.
We were becoming too civilized, too effete, and that somehow, also part of my story is that he's very much steeped in the kind of cultural evolutionary racial ideas of the, you know, the white race is superior and everybody else is down lower on the evolutionary scale. Those were the ideas pervading his time, the kind of racial superiority that informs imperialism, but TR moved away from it.
He does, and your book clearly has animated me, but there are contradictions in him that are really quite extraordinary. For example, the same time he's in this milieu of believing this racialism or accepting it as the worldview. But he's also a Lamarckian by virtue of being a scientist.
Right.
So he has to believe that people can become other than what they may have been born, no matter what he may have thought of that.
That's right. And the fact that TR was a scientist makes him a little bit different from any other president and makes him different from many of the intellectuals of his time, because he believed that by research and theory and advancing knowledge, that our knowledge would change. And so that as a Lamarckian, even though people today laugh at Lamarckians, in fact, he believed that you could change the potential of any group of people by environment.
Right.
And so that environment would reshape. He wouldn't talk about it in terms of genes because that was before Mendel had an impact intellectually. But he believed that any group could rise to equal potential, and so that made him more willing to say, well, maybe this cultural evolutionary scale isn't permanent; it's a temporary one, and we're going to see people changing, growing, and especially when he looked at immigrants, he saw immigrants with good nutrition and education moving into the American mainstream, and he defended them as equal to anybody. With black-white issues, he's a little bit more complicated.
We're going to get to that in just a minute, because that is a fast, that in itself, the black-white issue is an extraordinarily important one. Here's a tricky, at least for me, a
a tricky question even to think about, and it may be the classic puzzle within an enigma sort of thing. It was very difficult, still is difficult for me, as to know where to place him on the conservative to liberal spectrum, if you will. And the race thing, which you mentioned just a few moments ago, really kind of, for me, brought it to a point. For example, he was schooled clearly in the racialism of his time. No one could avoid that, particularly a man of his class, so to speak. Yet his famous White House dinner for Booker T. Washington clearly was held. It caused him enormous political difficulty. There were certain senators from the South in particular who just never did stop going after him. But the book brings out that wasn't the first dinner. There was a fellow named Henry Burley who had had dinner with Theodore and Edith earlier.
Yeah, I don't think T.R. was personally prejudiced. If William Lewis, who was a black lawyer, who he had to Sagamore Hill. This is a football player. This is somebody he shares ideas with and politics with. And Harry Burley was a really gifted singer.
Right.
Some of the black people he knew, he treated as equals and could talk with them if he had something in common with them. So I think he wasn't as personally racist as our friend Woodrow Wilson.
Well.
Yeah. That's another issue.
We'll pass over that in silence because that would take us another program to discuss his issues. Let me add this because I think you're right. And here's what fascinated me. There was also, for example, the postmaster in Mississippi, Minnie Cox, who was under a challenge. And I think he at least was sympathetic to her plight and her case. But what struck me most, actually, was kind of an aside in the book. And it takes place when he goes to the St. Louis exhibition. And he goes to this exhibition, and then he says, you know, almost in passing, I hope there's going to be one for African-Americans in Jamestown, or they have some exhibition there to chart their progress over 300 years.
Right.
And what struck me about that was, now this is not really a public pronouncement, it's sort of him thinking or adding on to it, or saying something that was clearly meaningful to him when he didn't have to say anything. And it struck me as, you know, there's a lot more to this man than, you know, on this issue. There's some real concern.
Well, and I think that's true. And I think the fact that it comes back, in his book collection, he had Phyllis Wheatley, and he read, he knew more about African-American cultural contributions and about the importance of black culture in America. Mm-hmm. But this is in a time when people said there was no black culture.
That's right.
And that blacks were inferior and not very smart. And that was the standard line that you get from most people like T.R. T.R. knew that was wrong. What's sort of tantalizing about him is that even though in 1912, when he's running on the Bull Moose party ticket, and W.E.B. Du Bois, the great intellectual, comes to him and says, could we have an anti-lynching and anti-segregation and public accommodations plank in the Bull Moose platform? And T.R. says, no, that's too radical. You know, I'll get lynched. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, it would have been disaster for the party to do that. Mm-hmm. It's too bad he didn't do it, but it would have been political disaster. Du Bois then goes to support Wilson, which was a mistake. But T.R. and Du Bois wind up, you know, these are two of the great intellectuals of their time, and Du Bois is really angry at him and says bad things about him later on. Mm-hmm. But the last public speech that T.R. gives is with Du Bois, and together they stand up raising money for what they call Negro War Relief and helping the soldiers who did go and were treated very badly in segregated troops in World War I. Mm-hmm. And T.R. and Du Bois raised money together. And Du Bois said, well, I'll bet he regrets what he did in 1912, and he's quite a man. And T.R. promised Du Bois in this public place, my next agenda is I'm going to try to see that African Americans get a little justice because they sure haven't. So he was going to run for president in 1920, and so who knows what, you know, was it an empty promise?
Well,
we just don't know whether...
But the fact we don't know, Kathleen, is what tantalizes us, isn't it? I mean, because it wouldn't even be a question if there wasn't some capacity for growth and some use of intellect. And that is my next question, because... Well, let me use my own shorthand and have you criticize it. Because of this kind of thing, and you know, and where he was going, I began to see his life as kind of a progression leftward, if you will. I mean, here you know, born to privilege and all of that sort of thing, but here's a man who you mentioned Du Bois, Jacob Riis, the great Danish-born social activist, one of his closest friends and an influence on him. Early feminists also have a very, very strong influence on him. And then there's this business of his fellowship in the sense of bonhomie with immigrants and laborers and so forth. So, you know, he's going somewhere mentally, intellectually all the time.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes I describe my book as a Horatio Alger story. Mm-hmm. From, you know, it's not rags to riches. It's from being a mainstream Victorian elite person who just accepted all the myths and the beliefs of his time to somebody who really questioned. He was moving on the same path as Franz Boas, who said, these racial categories are all wrong. Mm-hmm. He was moving on the same path as Du Bois, who said, give us a chance. Everybody's has equal potential. And T.R. was moving on towards seeing, based on his experience and his reading, mm-hmm. he, by the end of his life, not only saw equal potential and a lot of humanity in every one of the ethnic groups who were really quite downtrodden by the end of his life, and he also really wanted the government to be an active force,
absolutely.
To mediate for good. And that was, he wanted government to be for social justice.
Just a quick comment on that. I think for the modern reader, it will be astounding to realize just what you mean by the downtrodden, not just blacks, but immigrants as well. I mean, it was an age of peonage when people could be forced to work in certain places, an age of goon squads and the police in many places being corrupt and upholding the moneyed classes. So it's quite an ugly story that he had to confront.
Right.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Kathleen Dalton, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Kathleen Dalton, author of Theodore Roosevelt, A Strenuous Life. The Western experience. He owned two ranches in the Dakotas. I'm not sure if it was north or south or both or what.
Well, it was the Dakota Territory.
Territory, and
north,
that's right, yeah. But, you know, that struck me as really kind of extraordinary, too, because most of the presidential candidates, or presidents I've been used to, have been creatures of one given reach or another. This man had his feet in two very different camps. I mean, the Eastern establishment world, and then this rough-hewn world that in many ways made a big part of him. And I wondered, did you find that particularly striking? I mean, that was just, it's like these two, and it wasn't just the fact of being there physically, it was something philosophical he drew from both of these sources.
Well, one of the things that I find charming about T.R. is his ability to learn from his experience and his he was not alone in the fact of being an elite man who went west. Mm-hmm. A lot of people went west for their health. Mm-hmm. A lot of his friends went west, and that was a common experience. But very few of them became such valued members of the community. T.R. turned out to be a good neighbor. He'd organize funerals and he'd help people. And he didn't expect people to wait on him. Mm-hmm. He always said that you'd learn a man's character if you went camping with him. And
right.
It was sort of like going camping with most of those people in the West were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew he was rich. And they might have had a chip on their shoulders about this rich guy who handed out $100 bills mm-hmm. to his hunting guides. But in fact, he was very down to earth. And he knew he had some things to learn from them.
Right.
And he did. So that, I mean, I think that's something very different about T.R., that he was willing to travel and change and learn. He had an openness towards life.
Is there a darker strain as well? And let me say why I would ask that question. There is one incident in the book that's kind of striking where he's a very young man. He's riding a pony at fast gallop, and a dog comes out at him. He shoots the dog immediately. Then there's another incident later on in a very different context. He's older. And it's some, I forget the details, but I know it's an argument, obviously, it may be a political thing, but he knocks the fellow down. And, you know, is there kind of an impulsive violence to him, too, that he could come out if he's not constrained?
I think it's truer as a young man. I think for most of his adult life it wasn't especially true. But the dog incident, certainly an emotional outburst. The punching the young man out That's a story in my book about a young man saying, "Well, let's all toast to our sweethearts, our friends' wives." And so it's a moral, outrage.
Yeah,
and so that's very much like TR, that he would punch a man out for saying something like that. So that's I can't think of too many examples of his violent outbreaks. He does have a little bit of an intolerance strain. I was at the Library of Congress talking about TR's moment where TR tries to have a Library of Congress employee fired for complaining about his policies because he considered it treasonous to the government.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's really that's probably not as tolerant of diverse viewpoints as he could have been. So
that's a good answer because you remind me that he was, and I think we owe to you to quote our most intensely moralistic president.
Absolutely, and in some senses, that's why he cared so much about social justice.
Exactly, that accounts for, as I marked down here, I'm going from his civil service reform to the later conservation and public health things. I mean, you can see it takes someone with a strong moralistic bent, I think, to care about that.
Well, I think progressives generally were pulled into reform in part because of moral concerns and in part because of a religious atmosphere. But and that's part of the mood of the age. He argued that you had to pay a living wage to women workers because that's the only thing that would stop them from going into prostitution. And so that he got to the living wage and advocacy of women workers from a moral route.
Right.
And old age insurance and unemployment insurance. Part of that was that people would turn to gambling and drink and prostitution if, in fact, they didn't have things that would pull them into middle class life. Yeah. That's a very classically progressive outlook.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the reasons we got so many reform ideas out of that generation.
Exactly. So here's an impossible question, Kathleen. for the time allowed to it,
okay.
which unfortunately is all too little. But internationally, he produced what I call remarkable and contrasting results. He was, I quote myself here, aggressive in securing the Panama Canal, diplomatic in the Portsmouth Treaty ending the Russo-Japanese War, for which he won the Nobel Prize, first American to do so, forceful in his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, yet paternalistic and somewhat interventionist, I thought, in terms of Latin America, or at least paving the way for that to happen.
Yes.
What's your verdict?
Well, my verdict is that's all true. The two sides of TR's foreign policy are one is the imperialistic and kind of condescending to Latin America, intervening in the Caribbean a lot. Panama certainly not a moment of respect for Latin American sovereignty. But on the other hand, he was an advocate of international organizations before Woodrow Wilson and argued for a League of Nations and tried to get Latin America included in international tribunals and the Central American Court of Justice. Lots of things. He argued for imperialism's not working. Later in life, he saw that we needed international structures of government and law to help organize and conflict and also to prevent war, so that and he was a really effective diplomat and peacemaker. So he's very complicated in terms of foreign policy. So that people who stereotype him as just the warmonger miss the point. He's both, but this, you know, you can't whitewash him.
Yeah.
Some people want to whitewash him and say, "Oh, what a great diplomat." Well, just don't forget some of those other things.
Exactly.
He's both. You have to have both to really understand TR.
Him.
Yeah.
We've mentioned Woodrow Wilson several times, and toward the end of his career and his life, this was his great enmity, wasn't it? I tend to think he had a real visceral dislike of Wilson.
Well, TR and Wilson had been friends, and then really allies.
Wilson was at Princeton, wasn't he?
That's right. Wilson would come to the White House and visit TR because they were very much like-minded in terms of reform and trying to get. They both worked together to try to get young college men to go into politics. So that you would think they would be friends, but then words were said in 1912, and then TR criticized Wilson's unwillingness to stand up to Germany after the Lusitania sinking in 1915, and then later on, I thought that Wilson didn't prepare for World War One. He saw it coming, but he refused to prepare. So TR criticized Wilson constantly. I think what was hard for TR is that Wilson had the power and he didn't. But he also, TR sent his four sons to war in a very disorganized war effort, and Wilson didn't run a very organized war effort. Yeah. So I think there's tremendous passion. Wilson did not especially care for TR at that point either, but did admit maybe the world would have been a better place if TR had, you know, been president or stayed in office. And I think they had a lot in common. They believed in a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. So it's a shame that partisan competition and demonizing each other got in the way of good policymaking.
But exactly. But that's what happened.
It did then, and it does now. So.
Well, with that comment. And in fact, as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, all too soon for me, quite frankly, then and now is what's on my mind, because this is a presidential year. And as I said at the outset, people are invoking the name Teddy Roosevelt like a mantra all over the place. I mean, you'll hear it at every level of politics. It's very interesting. Even local politicians will do it, and national politicians at some point are almost bound to do it. In an answer that could be a program in its own right, but if you were asked just to briefly comment and say what contributions and qualities of his are most important for celebration or remembrance and emulation, rather, in this political year for this country?
Well, I think TR was a true Democrat, in the sense, a small-d Democrat, in some of the same ways that Thomas Jefferson was. He really believed in government by the people and that people should rule. I think he was very worried about special privilege, and he hated the Hearsts of his time, the media moguls, who told people what to think. Mm-hmm. And I guess that if TR were to speak from the grave to us, the fact that America now has, was it five or four, maybe tomorrow it'll be four media conglomerates telling us what to think about every moment. The primary system has really been corrupted by the media. And I just think we're not getting to choose. Pundits are telling us what to think. And I think TR would be outraged. And he was an emotional man because he would get angry about injustices. And I think in an election year where one candidate in particular has been eliminated because of showing emotion in the wrong way, TR wouldn't like that. I think emotion, anger and emotion are really how we handle things we feel very strongly about. And we should feel very strongly about American politics. It's our life and our children's lives. So I think TR would argue for more democracy and fewer pundits.
Well said, Kathleen Dalton. Or should I say delighted?
Bully.
Bully for you. Thank you for coming to Dialogue.
Oh, well,
it's really been a pleasure.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for the book.
Oh, well, thanks. Great.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Kathleen Dalton, author of Theodore Roosevelt, A Strenuous Life. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds.